Hello and welcome to episode 84 of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. This is Janae Libby. Want to thank Teej.fm, that is T-E-E-J.fm. It is a podcast collaborative created by WTJU. It's a group of UVA students and community members who are all podcasters. So check out Teej.fm and check out all the podcasts being created each and every day here in Charlottesville, Virginia. Also want to thank Patreon.com, patreon.com/audaciouspod. It is a site that allows creators to create for as little as $1 a month. You can sponsor a creator like a podcaster such as myself, making sure that they stay solvent. Thank you to Patreon.com. Just got a new sponsor this week. More about that later. I'm rambling. Let's get to the show, shall we? Here we go. Hey guys, welcome to Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons, where food is just the starting point for many, many deeper conversations on life, on love, on success. You know, this is episode 84. Oh, thank you for being my guest. I always start with that. Let me back up. Thank you for being my guest today. This is episode 84, and I kid you not when I say that I am afraid every time I sit here and record. I don't know. I guess I think I'm going to fumfer. I'm going to say something stupid. I procrastinate it to the last minute every single time. Who am I? Let me just start talking. Maybe the fear will dissipate. I am Janae Libby. I'm a writer. I'm a podcaster. And I do this to connect with people rather than talk about them online. I only record face-to-face. It's a value. It's a goal that I set for myself here at the beginning. I want to look them in the eye. I want to read their body language, understand if they are as scared as I am, as trepidatious. Maybe they're comfortable. Maybe I can ask a tricky question because they've leaned back in their chair. I think we need to have more face-to-face conversations. I think we spend too much time online, and that's why I do that. Thank you so much for being here. You can find me at iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. If you have an Android, if you have an iPhone, just find the Purple Podcast app and search E-D-A-C-I-O-U-S. I also have a website, audacious.co. Today's interview is with Travis Croxton of Rappahannock Oyster Company. Amazing talk. Travis is someone I've been courting to have on the podcast for quite a while. I first enjoyed his oysters at Cardinal Point at their annual oyster roast and festival that they have the second week of November every year. More on that later. Boy, do I have a lot on my mind. I will try and not talk a lot, but God, November, October, there's a lot happening. There's a lot happening. Me too, the hashtag me too. I've had that on my mind quite a bit this week because it's been trending. John Besh has stepped down from his restaurant group because 25 women came forward and accused him of sexual harassment, and he has admitted to it. And if you work in the food industry, if you have ever worked in the food industry and you are a woman, or maybe even as a man, you have experienced this. I know the kitchen culture of the 80s has calmed down quite a bit. Tony Bourdain wrote about it in Kitchen Confidential. They even tried to make a TV show with it, including it. It was terrible. Bradley Cooper, what were you thinking? I have experienced it myself. I won't go into it. It was at a bakery in Richmond, and a lady and I worked together in the morning, and Helen Rosner actually put out a call for stories about sexual harassment, and I did email her my experience. I hope by talking about it that we can lessen it. We can teach. We can use it as a teachable moment. We can not only learn the stories of the women who have experienced it, but we can teach the young chefs, male and female coming up, that this is unacceptable, that people should always be treated with respect it doesn't have to be a stiff kitchen. Sure, you're going to cuss and fuss and joke, but there's a way to do it. There's a way to do it to not make the other person feel less than. And I will be moderating a panel next week as part of the Fire Flower Fork Festival in Richmond, and it's Women in Food. The panel includes Carrie Diamond of Cherry Bomb, Kristen Kish, she is a Top Chef winner, Joy Crump, she was a Top Chef finalist, and the fourth person, Rebecca Wilson. Oh, I'm so sorry, Rebecca. Jessica Wilson. Jessica Wilson, she is a restaurateur in Richmond. She will be opening a restaurant in Chimborazo, and we will be talking about this. This will be just one of the topics, women and food. Hopefully it's not going to be all, you know, heavy and serious. We'll have some fun stuff too, but I bet it comes up because this has been in the news so much lately. Also on my mind is Bashir. If you have been to Bashir's Taverna on the downtown mall, he is a beloved chef here in Charlottesville, and he needs a double knee replacement. I will put the link to his GoFundMe on my website in the show notes. Please give early and often. He and his wife run that restaurant without help. They do it all. They are in their 70s, and they have been around a long time, and the food is wonderful, and they are so dear and so wonderful and so nice. And please, please help support his knee replacement, because as we know, if you work in the food industry, the insurance is terrible. Want to send a quick thank you to everyone who was involved in the farm dinner at Caramont that I attended on Sunday. If you were there, you know what I'm talking about. This is an event for the community, by the community. My husband and I have stopped going to beer dinners and wine dinners because they end up being very stiff, formal affairs. This never is. Gail Hobbs Page, Ian Bowden of The Shack, the wines, oh my God, who was that? P.K. Ross was there from Splendoris, Sarah Aducci was there from Feast, we had wines from Cardinal Point, we had wines from Jake Bushing, Blanc Creatives was there, Corey Blanc was pounding out pans and showing how he blacksmiths and creates his artistic, beautiful pans. Food was cooked over the grill. We were outside with the goats and the chickens and the crickets. And I will be posting this dinner. I was recording. It was my first live event. I talked to folks about Thanksgiving. And I will be airing this episode on Thanksgiving Day. So please listen for that. And thank you to everyone who was involved with this dinner. I left with my heart feeling very full. I felt full of gratitude and good feeling and good food, and it buoyed me forward to continue the work that I do here at Audacia. So I'm so, so grateful to Gail Hobbs Page of Caramont Farm and her team for putting together such a stellar event. There will be another one in the spring, so look for that. She does this twice a year, folks. And if you go to no other food event in this town, you should go to that one. You know, I love events like the farm dinner because I always end up meeting new food folks that I've either read about or heard about, and I get to meet them in such a wonderful way outside with cider in my hand. This time, I got to meet Brian Noyes and Dwight from Red Truck Bakery. Thank you, Ian Bowden, for introducing us. They are delightful. I actually wrote an article about them a couple years back. So it was nice to finally meet them face to face. And yes, we are in talks to have him on the podcast, to have them both on the podcast. Red Truck Bakery in Warrenton and Marshall, my old stomping grounds. That's up where my dad lives in Front Royal. And this farm dinner will always go down in history as the farm dinner where I sat across from Micah Lamon for 45 minutes and did not know it was him. I feel like such an idiot. His father-in-law and mother-in-law mentioned his book, The Imbible, and I went, oh my God, are you Micah Lamon? Boy, am I old. Ay, ay, ay. He's so quiet. And it's funny, I've had his cocktail so many times, but it didn't click. I don't know what he looks like, evidently. And yes, we are in talks to have him on the podcast. It's a great book. I adore it. So it was very nice to have formal introductions with him as well. Yikes. Yeah, I gotta be better about recognizing folks. And speaking of Thanksgiving, I'm doing something a little different here at Audacious. As part of the Farm Dinner Thanksgiving episode, if you would like to be on the podcast, you want to be famous for a hot minute? Record a voice memo on your phone telling me what Thanksgiving means to you. How do you know it's Thanksgiving in your house? Is it a scent? Is it a dish that you make only that time of year? Is it a relative who comes to visit? Is it a certain song you hear? A certain smell? A certain event you go to? Say your name, where you're from, record a voice memo telling me all that good stuff and email it to contact@audacious.co and I will put you on the podcast airing November 23rd, Thanksgiving Day. And before we get to today's interview, I've got a couple of thank yous to some Patreon sponsors. I was saying Patreon, I think, for about 70 episodes. It's actually Patreon. And I want to thank my newest sponsor, Jay Lester. Jay, my mentor, sponsored me at $5 a month. I also have two other sponsors, Martin Herbert and Jeff Dion. For $5 a month, guys, you get stickers and access to unposted material here at Audacious. It might be outtakes. It might be funny jokes that we talk about that don't make it into the podcast. Maybe you see a behind-the-scenes filming of my studio, how I edit. Maybe it's pictures and video that I don't post on Instagram. All kinds of extras. So check out patreon.com and thank you to Jay Lester for being my newest sponsor here on the podcast. And speaking of sponsors, how about we hear from a few of our newest sponsors who paid $25 to get their event announced on the podcast. Are you interested? Contact@audacious.co for more information. Friday, November 10th, guys. I'm calling this the Audacious Concert Calendar. Events happening here in Charlottesville. There's always a ton of them. They're always wonderful. Friday, November 10th from 5 to 9. Head over to 1304 East Market Street in Charlottesville. Firefly. Have you been to Firefly? It's a fantastic space. Melissa Meese and I are actually going to collaborate on having some live Audacious events at Firefly. On November 10th, they are doing their Cider Week kickoff event and tap takeover. That following week is Cider Week in Virginia, and they are doing a kickoff event on Friday, November 10th. If you like cider, as I do, 9 local cideries will be represented during Cider Week, either on tap or by the bottle or the can. And on the 10th, you can meet the cider makers, sample some new ciders, and enter to win great raffle prizes. They also have non-alcoholic ciders, so head out to Firefly at 1304 East Market Street here in Charlottesville on Friday, November 10th from 5 to 9. Firefly is proud to be Charlottesville's most cider-centric restaurant. Get yourself some cider. Go play some skee ball. They've got classic video games there. You can just hang out. They've got outdoor space too. It's a gorgeous space. I am planning on using it a lot here in the future, especially because they got some cider on tap. And I bet I go to this event. So come on out Friday, November 10th from 5 to 9. And today we've got a second event on the Audacious Concert Calendar. Are you ready? It's the 14th annual Oyster Roast at Cardinal Point Winery. The 14th? Oh my God. I've been to many. I think the Oyster Roast was one of the first events that we went to when we moved here in 2008. This is the 14th year. It will feature oysters and other goodies from Rappahannock Oyster Company. Yes, we'll be talking with Travis here in just a few minutes. It is November 11th and 12th, that Saturday and Sunday from noon to 5 each day. Admission is $15 in advance, $20 the day of. They have sold out in the past. In the past, meaning every year. I know Saturday always sells out. So Bruce and I have actually gone and been turned away at the gate because we were stupid and didn't buy tickets ahead of time. I would urge you to get your tickets ahead of time because they do close the gates if they reach capacity. There is live music. Saturday, it's the Atkinsons, and Sunday is Ian Gilliam and the Fire Kings. Picnics are welcome, but please, please do not bring your pets. And don't bring your alcoholic beverages either. They will have wine. It's the Cardinal Point Winery. Get you some green. That's my favorite. Oh, I just had the A6 at the farm dinner. That's a good one, too. And it's got a nice minerality, so the A6 would go really well with the oysters. 14th Annual Oyster Roast, November 11th and 12th, noon to 5. Get your tickets early. Be there, guys. This is a good event. Do not miss it. Today's interview is with Travis Croxton of Rappahannock Oyster Company with his brother Ryan. I'm not exaggerating when I say he's created a restaurant empire from one grill in Topping, Virginia. That's how they started out. One little grill in a marina in Topping. Gabrielle Hamilton will be appearing at Miroir in Topping, Virginia next Friday, November 3rd, as part of the Fireflower Fork Festival in Richmond. I will be attending, you know I will, because Gabrielle is my dream podcast guest. When I started this thing 2 years ago, I sat, got quiet, and said, who would be the pinnacle? Who would be the guest where you know you've made it? And it's Miss Gabrielle. So I'm going. I plan on stalking her until she agrees to talk to me. I'm envisioning myself chasing her down with my little recorder with the foam top. I'm hoping that she will speak at least a few words to me so I can get them recorded and get them to you because I know you want to hear it. And that event is sold out, but there are still 80 other events happening as part of Fireflower Fork, including the Women in Food panel that I will be moderating on that Saturday, November 4th. Check it out. I'll have the link in the show notes. And without further ado, let's get to Ryan. I hope you enjoy this talk, and I'll see you on the flip side. Travis, thank you so much for talking with me and sitting with me here in the Community Investment Collaborative this morning.
Well, thanks for having me. Anytime. Yeah. This would be great.
Yeah, it's funny. You have been... You and Ryan are some guys I've wanted to talk to for years, kind of since I started this. I've been following your progress as an avid oyster lover and native Virginian, and I can remember, you know, I'm 50, so I can remember when the oyster industry was non-existent.
Right.
Because of overfishing.
I mean, too long ago.
Right. Not at all. I mean, there were, you know, a good decade there where you're just like, well, yeah, Chesapeake Bay oysters. Nope. It's not going to happen.
Right.
So I love you guys. Thank you. Let me speak for the Commonwealth and the country. Thank you so much. I feel like you too have like single-handedly brought back the industry with your efforts.
Well, we've had tons of help and a lot of luck also, but the right place, right time. So we won't take too much credit for it, but it's a huge passion of ours.
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely, and fourth generation passion
that we know of
that you know of.
Yeah.
That was fascinating to me. I read so many articles about you guys. There's a lot out there because of your world domination that's happening with oysters, but I had no idea that it went back so far.
Well, I mean, the story of that is in the late 1800s, and sometime in the 1890s, there was a survey of all oyster grounds in Chesapeake Bay. It was called the Baylor Survey. And prior to that, you couldn't actually lease underwater grounds. So there were people, that's back when you had like the oyster wars and people like fighting over certain areas of river bottom or Chesapeake, the bay bottom. So with the Baylor survey, they carved off as public grounds any productive areas, anything that wasn't productive, they said, okay, private individuals can lease these areas. So they gave like private individuals the worst areas, of course. But so that led to people like my great grandfather who would buy spat on shell, and push over the boats onto their acreage that they have.
Yeah, and a spat is like a beginner, like...
Yeah, well, it's basically what they did is that there were a couple of places, like in the James and the Wicomico, where you have just areas that are productive for oyster seed. And
okay.
Then the oysters, when they spawn, basically, by chance, in the water column, egg, sperm, meat, they create larvae. Mm-hmm. The larvae actually swim around for 3 days, and on the third day, they have basically a foot and a cement foot. They look to like attach on some hard substrate.
Right, right.
The best thing that they like to attach on is other oyster shells. So that's why we had oyster reefs back in the day.
Oh,
they would just build upon each other. So each adult oyster would end up having, you know, 15 other oysters growing off of it. Like the clumps, right?
Yeah.
You know, down south, you know, they still have them. They call them clusters. We had reefs of these clusters. And so in the James and Wicomico, you had a couple areas that the water, the currents actually kind of like recirculated, went like in a circle. So the larvae would wash around but come back instead of just going further down the stream. And so they would have huge amounts of seed oysters, they called them.
Okay,
so they were just real live adult oysters with seed struck all over them.
Okay.
And then they would actually put those on a big boat and take them up to a private leaseholder's grounds and push them off the boat. And then the leaseholder would come back with a dredge in 3 years, bring them up, and take them to market.
Yeah.
Which was mostly a shucking house market.
Okay.
So the first year that you could really actually sign up to get a lease was 1899. And we found that with their great grandfather, James Arthur Croxton. That's what he did.
Well, and that it was near South Hill.
Right. It was
I've got family.
Jones Point area.
Yeah. That's where my family's from.
Oh,
that's
wow.
So funny.
Yeah.
I read that and I was like, holy crap.
Yeah.
I didn't know the river ran that far in.
Yeah. Well, this is on the border of Essex and Middlesex counties.
Okay. Gotcha.
So it's a little area called Jones Point. That's when we first saw a signature on a piece of paper dating back to 1890.
But it might have been before then.
Yeah, many people actually would farm the soil in the summertime and oyster and crab in the wintertime.
That's so cool. I read a lot of Joseph Mitchell. He was a correspondent for The New Yorker for like 50 years. He wrote a lot about the oyster industry in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is sounding really familiar.
Yeah, like, funny enough, we just did an event on Saturday in Durham with Andrea Riesling at the Durham Hotel, and Paul Greenberg, best-selling author, taught, you know, American Catch, Four Fish. He was there also with me, and we were talking about the New York oyster history.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
It's almost like happening behind the scenes. You've got these farmers, you know, they're farming the dirt, but then on their off season.
Right. Because you had to do something.
And,
you know, so that's what they did. And so James Arthur signed on 1899, and it was interesting for us, actually. Luckily, Ryan's parents actually kept like a lot of the historical artifacts that we had, and we had all these ledgers from every year. So going through that, we saw the evolution of the business. He started with 20 acres, and it increased slightly. Then you saw our granddad come into play, his brother, our great uncle, and then you saw it start expanding. And what I was interested in as a small businessman is in how they started, right? So my great granddad, he would partner with someone who had a lease.
Okay.
And he would do all the work and they would share the profits.
Oh,
then
nice.
He was able to like get his own lease. And then later on, his son, or granddad, got into it by he partnered with their great granddad. He did the work, split the profits. And that's how they kind of sharecropped and then got their own land and then grew it out that way.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating kind of like watching the evolution of having no leases to acquiring it by working with someone else on their lease, you know, sharecropping essentially, and then, you know, getting enough money to buy your own lease and expand out that way.
Now, I haven't been to every single one of your restaurants. It'd be...
Well, that's your fault.
Well, I know it is my fault. I'm sitting here like... I'm always brainstorming, designing. Do you have any of that paperwork, like in the restaurant, like as a display, or like use it as part of your story?
Yeah, we've filmed it. We've taken lots of pictures of it, and we have like our logo is actually the signature of our great grandfather.
That's so cool.
We took actually the cursive writing.
Yeah.
And parcel together like the letters.
That's so cool. That's so cool.
We named our company Rappahannock River Oysters LLC because that's what was on our granddad's letterhead. So we found that.
That's so great.
The books, you know, we have like hanging up, and we've shown them to documentaries and other filming that we've done and stuff.
Yeah.
But at some point, it would be nice to kind of replicate some of those and put them up on a wall, like blow them up and put them up on a wall.
Yeah, that's yeah. I've designed restaurants in my head in my spare time.
Yeah, well, we got lots of great old pictures too.
Absolutely. Nice. Yeah, I've been to Miroir, absolutely, of course. My God, I love that place. And Rock Salt is a regular hang for me.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's right.
Paul does a great job there. He works his tail off. He does fantastic food there. Real proud of him.
And I love that, like, indoor-outdoor bar, because you get a little outdoor. It's such a nice feature. It's so nice. And Rappahannock in Richmond.
Yep.
And I'm looking at Rap Session. Yeah. Is that new?
So this is...
I don't even know this place.
Yeah, so Rappahannock is... we've lucked out. Lots of our places are kind of one in a million shots. We're very lucky. So Miroir, you can't like replicate that anywhere.
No, it's a 360 experience.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've got the oyster shells under your feet. It's right there on a dock and topping.
The farm on the side where you can watch the processing, and then the view there is unbeatable.
Yeah, and that started with one grill.
Yeah, one grill. And Pete Woods.
That's crazy. I remember my friend Kendra Morris telling me.
Yeah, it's her fault.
Yeah,
she went down there and ate crabs and oysters, and then she blogged about it. Then other people had to come and check it out. So I blame Kendra for all this.
It's all her fault.
Yeah, it's all her fault. I tell her, I was like, look at all this stuff, that all these taxes I have to pay. It's all your fault.
Exactly.
Now we owe her a great deal of gratitude.
Did she get the VIP service when she walks through the door? It's like, oh, look, there's Kendra.
Well, I think she got it when she came that first time around, because Pete was like, oh, who's this blonde?
Right.
He's like, here, try this. So, anyway.
Absolutely. But yeah, God, that's such a beautiful space. I love taking day trips. We take day trips just to go to Miroir. I mean, it's like our destination for the day.
Yeah.
Do you feel like going to Topping today?
You can sit there for a long time. It's hard to leave.
No joke.
So it's a special place. We just opened up an Airbnb, a couple houses down. It's called the Oyster Bed for just for people to go down, stay.
Nice.
We're going to incorporate some oyster tours and some other like elements, so it's almost like an experience.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Like, so, to show people how the oysters are grown and farmed and the process.
Yeah, the whole ecotourism angle is one that's yet to be tapped in the Chesapeake, but it's Chesapeake's largest estuary in the country. It's got such history, and a lot of people are doing, like, cool things. So
yeah,
all of us need to, like, embrace that and, do these oyster tours, these crab tours, things like that. But,
yeah
we decorate out with books that on history of oysters, or cookbooks that we've been featured in, or just, you know, and the history that you're talking about, shots of their journals and things like that. So it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And the more you educate folks in sustainable practices, the less risk there is of that overfishing happening again.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, more people know about it. Why did overfishing happen? Like what?
Yeah, it's, I tell everyone it's just like the Lorax. I mean, it happens with every natural resource mankind has. We exploit it to the point of exhaustion, So if you look at like Long Island Sound, you know, the New York area, San Francisco Bay, they exhausted their native oyster population in the 17 and 1800s. I mean, early on.
Whoa.
So when people talk about blue points in New York as being the preeminent oyster, which isn't talked about anymore, but it was when we started this thing. They were just relayed Chesapeake oysters because the Chesapeake was so massive with the population of oysters that for about a century, schooners would come down from New York and load up with Chesapeake oysters and take them back, either sell them immediately or put them over in the Sound for a month or two and grow them up and then resell them as the blue points.
Interesting.
So their whole industry after like the 1800s was Chesapeake oysters. no one knows about that. But
so it was almost like they overfished Long Island area. So they're like, well, let's head down south.
Right. And so the Chesapeake and the Gulf of Mexico were so prolific, it took centuries of over-harvesting to finally collapse it, which happened in the 60s and 70s, really like the 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And so what happens, like if you took like the human population and took it down to 1%, you wouldn't have enough versatility to ward off different diseases and things like that that could strike, so you'd be extinct.
Yeah.
So that's what happened with the oysters. There was, no real strong broodstock was left to replicate.
Yeah.
And also with the dredging and destruction of other reefs, you didn't have anywhere that even larvae could strike and set upon. So there was just mud, right? That's why the Chesapeake was, you say, murky, because there's sediment, it isn't like lying in place. It's actually just floating.
Right.
So when you come to our farm, the good news is that you can actually see all the way to the bottom. It's crystal clear.
No kidding.
The oysters just filter so much. We've, whereas dredging took away all the subaquatic vegetation, underwater grasses and such, which provide sanctuary for baby fish, baby crabs, the whole ecosystem. The filtering of the oysters, letting the sunlight penetrate, creating oxygen. We now have vegetation everywhere on our farm. It's crazy. And so that holds sediment in place, makes the water even clearer.
Yeah.
And the biodiversity of the underwater ecosystem is increasing again.
Yeah.
We'll pull up seahorses, all kinds of baby fish, just everything. So
that's so cool.
It's really cool to see it working. Oysters are just the cornerstone of the ecosystem.
Cool. And when you say cornerstone,
they're the building blocks.
Yeah.
Without them, there's really nothing.
Almost like a coral reef.
Exactly.
In a way.
Exactly.
Folks forget how delicate and fragile the sea is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if one thing goes, it all collapses.
Right.
It's like a deck, like a house of cards.
Well, with the lack of oysters in the water from the over-harvesting and the diseases of the 70s and 80s, you didn't have that filtration. And without the filtration, the Chesapeake wasn't something like medical pollution, like in New Jersey or anything. It was too many nutrients from nitrogen and phosphates runoff. So nothing that's unhealthy for you to eat, just too much of a good thing. So without oysters to actually eat that, well, those two things create algae. And without oysters to eat the algae, you just had these blooms where sunlight could not penetrate, and you'd have these dead zones, so where no oxygen can get to the water. So that's why you read about all these fish kills, because there were these dead zones, depleted of oxygen in the bay. That's what it was. So by introducing more oysters through aquaculture, we kind of eliminate that.
It's like nature's filter.
Exactly.
And you just explained something to me. We tried to take our dog to Chris Green Lake Park Sunday, and we couldn't swim because there was toxic algae in the lake.
Yeah.
And we were like, what is that? So, it's probably a dead zone. Like, there's the heat or whatever.
I got fertilizer runoff, and then combined with heat and everything. Yeah, exactly.
So, oh, my God.
So.
Now, if you go to an oyster farm, can you visualize it for us? Like, how big is it, and what do you see? Like, you, I'm imagining you go out on a boat, and there's just like rows and rows of something. Like, how what does it look like?
Well, they're different sizes, obviously, and there's different techniques. So we rely mostly on purely underwater cages. Okay. We realize that there's lots of homeowners who've spent tons of money to have a picturesque view.
On the river.
Exactly. So yes. all our cages are, basically we have these, what's called long lines, and we have these PVC coated wire mesh cages that each of them can hold about 2,000 adult oysters.
Okay.
Those each have a leader line that attaches to the long line. And long line is maybe like 100 yards. So our boat pulls up, we pull up the long line, and we just like run down the line and pull up our cages with a winch system, okay. Like a crane system.
Okay.
And we bring those in and perform husbandry on our dock where we resize them and get them into similar size classes, okay. And then separate them back out again. Others have floating systems, which they work really well when you are in a desolate area. Not so great when you have homeowners. So we are okay. Running into the NIMBY business, which is not in my backyard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I support oyster aquaculture. I love it. It's fantastic what you're doing, but I want to see it in my backyard.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. So it's on us as farmers to be cognizant of that,
sure.
And not overly pushy, because we can accomplish what we want to underwater, and in places where there are no homeowners, leverage the floating cages.
Right.
Floating cages are faster, easier, make a harder shell, but it's almost like cheating.
like pushing nature forward a little bit
too much, because aquaculture grows them too quickly. Versus like the old days, it would take 3 years to reach the market size. And with aquaculture, we can do it in about a year and a half, 2 years.
With
floating cages, it's even quicker. But sometimes the meat isn't as mature as you would like it, even though the shell looks 3 inches, right? So
okay.
On our farm, we do lots of tumbling, lots of manual, repetitive laboring to harden up the shell, to make it a deeper cup. Through a tumbling process and make it just a better half shell oyster.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so when you come to Marwar, if it's on a work day, you get to watch our guys doing that process, which is really cool. People walk out on our dock and just kind of get mesmerized by the tube sorters we have, the upwellers we have.
I'd like to see that.
Stuff. It's fun.
That's so cool. Cool. I'll have to come out with the recorder and
I personally
witness
enjoy
it.
The land tour more than the water tour. It's just so much more to see. We have, we start with 1 million oyster seed that can fit into your hand, and then we have them in these upweller tanks. You can scoop them up and show kids, hey, look at these little baby oysters that look like a speck of sand.
It's
a really cool process, yeah.
That is really cool. And what about taste? Because Chesapeake Bay oysters have their own distinctive taste. Compared to other areas. So it's funny, it's amazing to me, I do all these interviews and it seems like every person I talk to that grows or produces something, it has its own terroir. Oysters have terroir too.
Yeah, and we've actually coined the term marroir.
Marroir,
so it's a
yeah.
Terroir with wine.
Yeah.
Because oysters take on the characteristic of the marine environment where they grow.
Yeah.
So whether it's minerality coming from the Blue Ridge Mountains running off down in the Rappahannock, or it's the salinity from the ocean, the type of algae that they're eating is different. All these impact the way it tastes, and the water conditions impact the way that the shell looks and the way it's shaped. So over in Chincoteague, we'll get some greenish hues on our shells because the type of algae and the salinity that we have, and they're sturdier because of the ocean pounding on them.
Sure.
So we call it marroir. And one of the light bulb moments that we had starting early on is that we went to Grand Central Oyster Bar in New York. You know, the the beacon of all oyster bars.
Yes.
And we read their truck board, and they had like 30 oyster varieties from a 2-mile stretch of Massachusetts. And they had one oyster from the Chesapeake. And the Massachusetts oysters all had their own brand names. The Chesapeake one just said Chesapeake. And so, you know, their parents, they both had kept, you know, lots of like oyster tins around the house. So we knew that back in the old days, 50s and 60s, that there were farms all over the Chesapeake Bay. Each one had their own appellation. That's what they called the oyster.
Yeah, yeah.
If you, you know, Google or eBay oyster tins, you'll see that Maryland and Virginia just dominated with that stuff. So, and now here we are in 2003 at the time, and we've the largest estuary in the country, the most productive estuary in the country. That was Chesapeake, actually means great shellfish. It was named after shellfish. Was relegated to one nondescript oyster.
Yeah.
The best oyster bar in the world. So that's when we were like, not only do we have to resurrect our Rappahannock farm, but we need to showcase the a couple other locations.
Sure.
And like show the world that we are the Napa Valley of oysters.
Yeah, like just like you said, a Chincoteague oyster is going to taste different than one
completely
from the river.
Different. Right. So that's what we did. So we immediately, at the same time as we were starting our Rappahannock farm again, we opened up a farm over in Chincoteague and one on the York River.
Nice.
And because they, you know, we had the Rappahannock sweet, mild, buttery, the York oyster, which we have renamed actually the Rochambeau oyster, is a moderate, it's a quintessential bay oyster. It's a mid salinity oyster, fat meat, and Chincoteague is just super salty, the saltiest oyster on the market.
Yeah.
So then we had three flavor profiles that we could showcase to chefs, and early on we learned, you know, some chefs, you know, like super salty oysters. So while they loved their story and their history, the Rappahannock wasn't for them. So then we had the old salts, and we're like, well, here you go. Here's salt George. So, all right, I'll take 500. So
God, they're all so good, too.
Yeah, so we were able to leverage that. And then, you know, that's why we call Marowar, the Marowar tasting room.
Mm-hmm.
So we could highlight the differences in flavors and nuances.
Yeah. I'm wondering, because you tumble the oysters and grow them, have you experimented with different methods and ways to kind of promote that taste? Like if you want them extra salty, or maybe you want these more sweet.
Right.
Are there things you can tweak as a farmer?
Just really like location has
the, it's the location,
most
of it.
Now,
yeah.
You can change how sturdy they are, or how they look by handling methods, but really like location is the influencer on the taste factor.
I'm wondering, oh crap, I just lost my train of thought. Something about determining taste and flavor. Oh crap. Well, if it's important, it'll come back to me. Has consumption changed of oysters from the 1800s to now? I feel like maybe back then they were more, like now they're still kind of considered a luxury item.
Yeah, that is a big difference. Early on, through mankind, it was a poor man and rich man's product. They both enjoyed it. You'd have monarchs slurping them down as a luxury item, and then you had beggars peddling oyster carts through New York City, right?
Yeah.
There were no hot dog carts, there were oyster carts. So it was one food that actually kind of brought people together, and that's one of the reasons that we opened up the restaurants, was to have that dialogue of bringing people together. We call it, you know, the third place. There was, before Starbucks, right, there were these, you'd work, then you'd go to a bar to socialize, then you go home.
Yeah.
And
so, I love that at Rappahannock, especially.
Yeah, you've that's got why that, we actually designed the bars that way.
It's nice.
That dialogue.
It's nice.
We did the same thing in Charleston, actually, with a really big bar too, where everyone can see each other.
Yeah.
So just foster that communication. And what I love is like walking around the bar, and I'll overhear like a regular telling a newcomer about the marowar of our oysters and explaining the whole concept of it. And that's what we wanted. But yeah, it was It was, I think, back in the 1800s, oyster meat was consumed more than butcher meat.
It was just
eaten all the time, everywhere. It was a staple of our diet.
Because it's so plentiful.
Right. And then it got lost, and then it resurrected itself in the form of boutique aquaculture, farm-raised oysters, which you would see up north and out west, whereas in the south, we still had so much in the Gulf of Chesapeake, we didn't use aquaculture, so it was seen as a lower product. And that's actually the disparity that occurred is, New York, Massachusetts, they had to resort to aquaculture 30 years ago. And that's why they got a head start on naming their oysters and branding them.
Oh, yeah.
And then we didn't have to because we still had such a huge, wild population that we were focused on the shuck market forever.
Huh.
So it was just, that's why, early on, we had a tough time selling a product because people looked at it as inferior because of that. So we had to educate them, no, these are farm-raised, just like up here. They taste fantastic. This is where oysters are meant to be grown. Get on board.
Yeah.
It took having really good famous chefs to get behind us to kind of clear that barrier.
Yeah, but talk about that a little bit, because when you first started, you and Ryan first started, you shopped your oysters out to someone pretty famous to say, here, try these. What do you think?
Yeah, we didn't know any better at the time. So
that's good.
My cousin, Will, Ryan's older brother, lived in Brooklyn. So we would take our oysters up on Friday night, drive up to Brooklyn, stay at his house, and Saturday and Sunday we would just have meetings. But going back just a little bit, one of the first trip we took up there that wasn't research was we had called actually LeBron and Dan. We looked up in Zagat what was the number one restaurant in the city and figured that we'd try that. So we called.
That's awesome.
And we'd never eat anywhere nice ever, right? So finding out that a chef had a secretary, I think it's called, and we're like, what kind of chef has a secretary?
Right.
That was interesting, but she liked our story, and it was pitching the history and everything.
Yeah.
She thought it was cute, so she passed it along, and the chef liked it. Eric Repair liked it.
My God, yeah, Eric Repair, yeah. Hello.
We didn't know at the time what that meant. So he was actually out of town, but he said, come on up, and we had an appointment with the chef of the cuisine, Chris Muller, who's still there today.
Oh, my God.
So we had our first sales meeting at the number one restaurant in the country at the time.
Wow.
We didn't know what we were doing.
What did you think when you walked into the restaurant?
It was,
I can't even imagine.
It was probably the most organized and well-run restaurant we've ever seen.
Yeah.
But that was also the first one that we've ever seen, the kitchen. And it's actually funny, looking back, the people that were line cooks or sauciers at the time, people like Jen Carroll.
Top Chef.
Who were like, I remember when you guys walked into our kitchen.
Too funny.
You guys were dumbasses.
Oh.
Like, yeah,
back
we were.
In the day.
But it was a
green.
Who's who that was in
yeah.
there. Yeah. I've said, yeah, I remember when you guys came in. But yeah, we didn't even know how to really shuck an oyster. So we tried, and Chris was like, hey, give me a knife. Let me show you how to shuck it. And then
oyster guys growing them, no shucking.
Yeah, not very well.
Yeah, how are you now?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah,
I got a few stab wounds, but I'm pretty good.
Yeah, I know the fish guy at La Bernadette's kind of a legend. Like he comes in, I saw a thing on him. He comes in at 4 a.m. every day, and he breaks down the fish, and he's like a samurai with a knife, and he's done by noon.
That's what you need,
right?
Restaurants, yep.
Buy
the fish whole and then cut it up to your needs and use the leftovers for stock, for sure. A lot of savings that way.
God. And I just remember the question I wanted to ask you. On an oyster farm, I'm imagining it's affected by weather, like any farm would be, and seasons.
Yeah, people think it's, you know, easy job. It's tough. I mean, you go out there right now in the heat, super hot. It's just really tough. We have to actually have a harvest in the summertime in by 8 a.m. So the guys have to get up super early, go out there, do all the work, bring in harvest oysters that we have. The rest of the day they spend on husbandry. In the wintertime, that's actually one thing we heard too. Hey, I like the cold water oysters. And I would always say, come out with us in December, January, February. I'll give you a cold water oyster.
It's plenty cold.
Yeah, so just that stupidity of that. But
yeah.
But it's freezing out there.
And it's a wet cold too.
Yeah, I remember the late Josh Ozersky was visiting one time.
Oh,
and it was
man,
the
I love that guy.
Coldest day ever.
Good writer.
Fantastic writer.
Yeah.
Great friend.
He was a friend of yours.
Yeah. Well, after his visits, yeah.
Yeah.
We became pretty close.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, he named Rappahannock the best new restaurant in 2014 for Esquire, which was great.
That's right. He did.
That was huge.
That's so cool. Little leg up.
But his first time visiting the oyster farm, it was one of the coldest days ever. It was like, I think it was like negative two. It was abnormally freezing cold. And we were just like, yeah, so do you want to go in the boat? And we're hoping he would say no. He's like, yeah, it'd be fantastic. So we go out there, and it's freezing. The waves are pounding at us. And he gives me his cell phone to take like a video of him for his one of his things that he did online. And I was like, I can't even use my hand. It's so cold. And he was just loving it. I was like, oh, it's miserable. But our guys had to work in that. The Rappahannock will sometimes ice over. We'll have to chainsaw our way out to the channel to get to our
You're
stuff.
Kidding. It's, and it, in Virginia.
Yeah, on occasion. It's tough, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, so it's a tough job. Our guys work really hard.
Well, and what about like hurricanes and storms and things like that? I mean,
yeah, that's, you know, we're at the potential to at any time lose our whole farm with the massive hurricane, right? Our cages are pretty heavy on the bottom, so we've had some hurricanes that shift them a little bit or knock over a couple of them, but we've been, knock on wood, incredibly fortunate. If we had the floats, they would have been decimated.
Oh, sure.
The surface floats, but the underwater cages have held up pretty well. There's lots of places have, when you have heavy rains, you have runoff, and then you have shellfish harvest closures.
Okay.
That's a lot of times in up north, like Massachusetts has a bunch of those, or actually out in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
The Chesapeake doesn't really have that. We've actually only been shut down twice, and that's when we had hurricanes that actually stall over us, dropping 20 inches of rain.
Oh, God.
That come down the mountains and things like that.
Yeah.
So we've been, that's only happened twice in 15 years, so we're very fortunate about where we are. And I tell people, hey, we have the cleanest, you know, waters in the country.
Yeah.
Really, especially, you know, the Rappahannock.
Yeah.
There's no town on it, no city on it. You know, it's just all forested, pretty much.
Right, right. And it's I'm sitting here thinking, Miroir only opened in 2011. I feel like you guys have been open. If I had to guess, I was going to say like 03, 04. And I'm like, really?
Just
it's only
gray
been
hair
that. Right. But yeah, since that,
it's been a quick 5 years.
It really has. I mean, since that time, how many restaurants are you at now?
With Rappahannock, we have the Oyster Bar in D.C.
Yeah.
And one more opening up on the waterfront up there next year.
Oh, so at the harbor?
D.C., at the wharf, yep.
Nice.
It's it's a huge project, I think $6 billion or so, and the building that they're not actually tearing down is this 18th century oyster shed that we're going into.
Oh,
so it's
cool.
Gonna be really cool, big patio area looking at the water, so that's gonna be really nice.
Got a name for it yet?
That's also gonna be called Rappahannock Oyster Bar.
Okay.
We just have a great menu up there, a great general manager and chef, so we're gonna let them preside over both places. So that'll be two up there. We just opened up Rappahannock Oyster Bar in Charleston.
That's
nice. March. That's doing great.
Yeah, that's a great market down there.
Yeah, Hannah Raskin, the food writer, gave us 4 stars, which we were super proud of because she never does that.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And it's also just educating people. We have fantastic oysters, but the food is so much more too. And we got great chefs working with us. Rappahannock in Richmond. You earlier asked about Rap Session. That's beside Rappahannock in Richmond. There's actually two entrances where you can get to either one.
Oh, cool.
And that's what we did that. So on the weekends, we had runoff for, you know, when we're just too crowded. It's actually smaller plates, more of a down dirty raw bar.
Okay.
But Dylan Fultonier is the chef over that also, so the food's fantastic.
Oh, it's so good. The burrito there is insane. Right. I love it.
And the cocktails in Rappahannock are fantastic, but Rap Session, I think, has the best in the city. I'm going to throw that out there right now.
Well, and you and Jason have done so much to revitalize that area. I mean, just I'm from Richmond,
yeah.
So I remember when that stretch of Grace was.
Well, yeah.
After five, everybody go home.
I blame Kendra on quite a bit, and we also blame Jason because we were looking at when Pasture was under construction. He's like, "Hey, yeah, come check it out." So it's before he almost opened, and we walked around there and said that. Looks great, man, but this is Gray Street. And then we walked down a
right.
block.
It's Gray Street.
Like, we saw the windows of the building that Rappahannock would go, and we're like, oh, we should do this too.
See? So, you had that vision. That's awesome.
So we just saw the windows. We're like, the place is historic. Let's do it. So those two places, and in November we're going to open up we're going to jump the shark and open up in Los Angeles.
Oh no! You're seeing we're jumping the shark. Why you're going to L.A.?
Yeah, we went out there.
Nice
to look at a space. No intention. We were called out there. And we're like, hey, let's go to Los Angeles for a trip anyway and see what they have to say. And the space just spoke to us like all the other ones did. It was the perfect size and we were an early signee, so got a really good deal. And so we were like, it's another challenge. So let's try it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, that's going to be a whole new set of, like strategy, getting the oysters to the West Coast.
Right.
and keep it. How do you keep your eye on that restaurant, make sure everything's going well and running well? And a question I had, there's so many restaurants, and each of them has a little bit different menu, a little bit different concept. How do you decide on that? Like, is it depend on what city it's in, or do you have a set idea about what you want to do?
It kind of just naturally evolved at Miroir. You know, Pete Woods came aboard, and I think our only interview question, because we were, you know, why would someone actually work for us with at this place with no, you know, we didn't realize what it could be. And we asked him, hey, how do you make a crab cake? And he said, 100% crab meat. We said, you're hired. And you saw the grill early on. So it just kind of adopted, hey, local rockfish, crispy skin, you know, just simple stuff. Let the food, like, speak for itself.
Yeah.
So he had his own technique and method. And then when we were actually looking at the Richmond location, thinking about, hey, maybe we just copy Miroir's menu, we got an email from Dylan Fultonier, who was working at he was Paul Kahn's right hand for 8 years at Blackbird.
Wow.
He went to work with Suzanne Goins at in Los Angeles, and he opened up her Hunger Cat in Santa Barbara. So I mean, we joke about it now, we're like, your last two bosses were James Beard, you know, huge winners, nominees, and now you're working for two rednecks.
Right.
What kind of move is that? But when, you know, we had like befriended him on a Chicago sales trip like a decade beforehand, and he just all, you know, we always like kept in touch, and he had summered in Chincoteague growing up in Pennsylvania, so he knew our product, the region, and he and his wife just had a baby. They're like, hey, we want to like head back east, you know, I've always been interested in doing a project with you. So when we like saw the email, we're like, all right, we'll sign a lease and we'll actually take the space beside it too, make it bigger, and he's got carte blanche on what he does there.
Yeah,
so which has worked out really well.
So nice.
And then he actually designed the original menu at in DC, and then we were fortunate to have Kevin and Kelly come on board, who took that, kept like the essentials that we had, the crab cake and the lambs and clams and stuff, and then added his own unique touch, and that's what Hannah and other people are raving about down Charleston. We moved him to Charleston to open that up. Mm-hmm. So that has a similar feel as their place in D.C.
Lambs and clams.
Yeah.
I love that dish.
That's a good one. And we do it actually differently at each location.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh,
everyone
my
has
head.
A very, like even Paul has, actually he's got my favorite one right now at Rock Salt. He does a different interpretation of it.
Yeah, my head just exploded a little bit because that's the only thing
I
order
ingredients
now.
And you guys figure out how you want to like change it up.
Right. I try and order different stuff, but I love it
you
so
keep
much.
Going back to it, yeah.
I keep going back to it.
Yeah.
It's
DC
such an interesting
really
pairing.
Mm-hmm. No one would ever thought about it.
No. Did he come up with that idea? Where are the origins of the lambs and clams?
Funny enough, it goes back to the second lamb stock. And it goes back to Hungry Cat in Los Angeles. Dylan was out there. We actually went out there to visit him. And he had on a merguez topping on one of our clams and some sauce. And that was the first time I ever had that pairing. Fast forward to the second lamb stock down at Craig Rogers, the Border Springs Farm, and he had signed up Jason Alley to kind of replicate the lambs and clams dish, but Jason did it completely differently, adding that more sauce and stuff. And as I recall, prior to Jason sobering up, he had a rough night, and that was a morning dish to be cooked, so he had to pull in David Guas, a buddy of ours from DC, to help out. and together they made this fantastic dish. It was the one that we have at Marowar.
Yeah.
So we gave that recipe from Jason to Pete Woods, who then took it up even a couple more notches, and that was the original one. That was kind of more like a stew based, and then Dylan's. And the one that we do like in DC is fantastic too. It's just totally different though. Hmm.
And how is it different?
His is more less soupy.
Okay.
You could say more consistent consistency. More I guess pasty versus stewy.
Yeah, with different texture, different presentation.
It's got some aioli in there, and just it's more. A little more sherry.
That's so interesting. I never would have thought, because I would consider that y'all's signature dish. Mm-hmm. I would. But
yeah,
it's
the DC
variations
ones,
on a signature dish.
Right, yeah, so the Marowar one's been written about in D.C., that one that Dylan created and Kevin's kind of embellished. It's always on the Washingtonian's top 40 dishes or Washington. Post top 40 dishes every year.
Yeah.
It's a standard.
I'm kind of craving it now, sitting here talking about it.
I'm actually going to D.C. after this, so I'll probably get that today.
Well, I know. That is incredibly creative from a business standpoint because it encourages folks to visit each restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I love the lambs and clams at Rock Salt, but I didn't know it was different up in D.C.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I love it when everyone's like, well, my crab cake ratings of your restaurant are like this, and they like this one's number one, this one's number two, and this one's number three.
So that's different at each restaurant too.
They use a similar recipe, but they get to touch it up just a little bit,
tweak it a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to leave the conversation without educating folks on eating oysters, because I feel when most people hear oysters, they go, oh, it's raw, I'm not eating it. But there are a lot of ways to eat oysters.
Yep. Tons of ways.
Roasted is probably I love raw oysters, but I love them roasted.
Right.
I love them roasted. And what does that mean? How do you roast an oyster, and what do you serve it with? Like, how, for folks that have never done that or tried that.
So, yeah, my vision is one of the next concepts we want to open is kind of like a brew pub where you have just 20 different varieties of grilled oysters. So so it's similar like the roasted. Traditionally, people think of like oysters Rockefeller or things like where you have to have elaborate toppings on it.
Yeah.
I like just having a awesome sauce that you put on top and then put it in the oven or on a grill, caramelize it. The oysters are just barely cooked. They're hot, but they're not shriveled up. And then whatever sauce is caramelized, and it just tastes fantastic. So at Marowar, we do a sweet but hot barbecue sauce. We do angels on horseback, which is
That's a good
garlic
one.
Butter, Edwards ham. I mean, can't beat that.
Oh my god.
Dylan has a smoked paprika butter that he does. Kevin Charleston does a smoked jalapeno butter. I mean, these things are just—you can just eat 50 of them. They're fantastic.
Yeah, no kidding.
We have a really good. We don't actually do it at our restaurants because we don't have fryers or microwaves at any of them. But we, for certain events, we'll do like Cardinal Point up here. We'll do fried oysters, which we got a secret recipe for that.
Oh, those are so good.
Slightly battered, just barely anything on them. But then, yeah, you could have. Steam moisture party too, and if you see it at a supermarket, if you're scared of shucking it, you can bring them home, put them on a pan, put them in the oven, they'll open up. Put them on the grill, they'll open up.
Really?
You can then just take like a butter knife, and then you know once they open up a little bit, you can easily shuck it yourself without worrying
and not cut your finger,
about a puncture wound. Yeah.
Yeah.
So because I know that's a big drawback to. Retail consumers are taking them home and stuff, but if they can start that way with cooking them, then over time they get more and more confident. They might actually buy a shucking knife.
Yeah.
And then there's videos online about how to do it, but as a country we are not eating nearly as many oysters as we have in the past. So when everyone's like, "Hey, are you worried about the market kind of drying out?" I'm like, "No, we got room to vastly increase consumption."
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah.
Thank you. Again, thank you. And these are not like the chewy gum erasers, that you get at a steakhouse, like you said, topped with, bacon and a bunch of stuff.
Right.
I mean, these
where
are
you can taste oyster, yeah.
Yeah, plump, fresh. They taste like the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Grilled up with that little char on them.
Yep.
Oh, there's nothing better in the world.
Exactly.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
And what about if folks buy oysters, say they get over their fear,
mm-hmm.
and they buy a sack of oysters to take home and prepare, how do you store them? Like, what's the best way to...
You want to put them in the refrigerator.
Okay.
And just leave them there.
Okay.
They don't like, some people like put them in coolers on ice. Ice will melt or thaw, and then they'll re-ice them. They like to have a steady state of temperature.
Okay.
So the best is if you have room in your fridge, just leave it in there and eat them as you want to.
Okay.
If you have extra time, you can turn them cup side up, but with our oysters, you really don't need to, but that can actually draw out like a couple extra days shelf life.
Oh, okay.
When you purchase it, Whole Foods or somewhere, I mean, they should last you for 2 weeks when you bring them home.
That long?
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe 10 days in the summertime, but about 2 weeks normally.
And I ask that because you do sell them on your website.
On our website, We're in some retail markets also, but yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I
you can pick them up from any of our restaurants, even here in Rock Salt. You can pick some up and take them home with you.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
So I could walk in Rock Salt and say, "Hey, put some oysters in a bag for me."
Yeah, they'll do it. Dollar piece. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yep.
That just blew my mind too.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
My God, I don't even have to go to Whole Foods.
And
I can
clams
just...
also.
No. Really?
Yeah.
That's so creative.
Yeah.
That's so smart.
Well, and then they can do, if the shucker has a second, you can give a tutorial.
Yeah.
One thing we saw early on, like a cheating method, is you can actually just take scissors and cut the bill, just have an opening, and then you can just open up with a butter knife.
Oh.
So you don't have to do the hinge side with the sharp knife. So
okay.
There's some tips.
That'll save your fingers, too.
Tips and tricks where, you can eat them raw. And, presentation's not as awesome as at a restaurant, but who cares? You're just eating an oyster and
exactly.
liquor in it, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So,
do you ever just shuck one when you're out in the boat, like on the farm? Do you say, "Well, that one looks good. I'm gonna have a snack right now."
Yeah. No, I did. Actually, we had a filming on last Monday, Delicious Destinations, which will be out, I guess, in the fall sometime. But I had to do like 10 takes of.
Oh, you did.
One in the boat. But no, it's good. I mean, you can't get more primal than. Eating an oyster right out of the water.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah,
no kidding.
It's fun.
And they pair so well. Like, one of my favorite pieces of food writing is when Hemingway talks about oysters and Chablis together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just that dry, cold white wine with oysters. But they pair well with cider, with beer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're fantastic with almost anything. Yeah, if I'm eating a Rappahannock, I love to have a white wine of some type. Mm-hmm. But if I'm eating a salty, a briny, old salt from Chincoteague, I want a cold beer with it.
Oh, that would play nice together. Yeah. Like the flavors together. Fantastic. What are Rappahannock's future plans? I know you just got back from China, I want to say.
Yeah, we're in China. We're in Shanghai and Beijing. Immediately opening up in Los Angeles and the Wharf, yeah. The restaurant projects, and that'll tide us over for a little while. And the oyster side, we've relaunched the York Oyster as a Rochambeau oyster. We're increasing the size of that farm. We bought a facility on the mouth of the York leading into the Chesapeake Bay.
Cool.
We're introducing bay scallops over in Chincoteague. There's a couple articles a couple years ago on that.
Hooray.
So we got more seed this year. We had a washout last year, but this year we have.
And those are the tinier, they're
so
the smaller
scallops. They're not like
Nantuckets.
They're bigger than Nantuckets, but they're not the sea scallops. So they're about, I don't know, 2.5 inches, 3 inches. And the meat's just fantastic.
Oh, I bet.
You can eat it raw or grilled, like we were talking about with the oysters. Fantastic.
Yeah, I just had a scallop crudo that was incredible.
Yeah. So these are great. They were extinct in the early 30s. And so we're trying to bring them back.
That's amazing.
So we can do the same thing we did with the oysters. We'll be in a good place.
Yeah, I bet you can.
Yeah, they taste great. So we're working on that. And then we've outgrown their production facility, so we're now looking at expanding that operation. And one thing I talk about now that I never actually thought about is that not just us, but other people doing this, is that we're doing it in rurally, economically challenged areas.
Mm-hmm.
So just recently kind of dawned on us that we're actually creating a lot of jobs and good work tracks for people. So we put them on hourly, and if they show up on time and here for a year or so, we put them on salary and give them benefits and give them the career path. So that's one of the other. It's not just food benefits and health benefits of the Chesapeake, but also just the local economies, right? So a lot of those areas, young people go to college or just move to the biggest city around them and never come back.
Yeah.
So we're trying to help reverse that trend too.
That's true, because that area, Chincoteague, Topping, like I bet the kids like go to Hampton Roads or they come up to Richmond or whatever.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Thank you. That's so wonderful.
Well, it just kind of dawned on us that, hey,
just kind of happened.
We've got like a lot of like college graduates. We have a lot of folks that started blue collar and now they're actually white collar with us, and they're smarter than we are. And they just needed a chance to show themselves, right? That's been really cool, is watching their people grow and expand and take on new challenges. They've surpassed anything that Ryan and I ever dreamt of or thought of or did ourselves.
Yeah, God, that's so great. And you guys are such a successful business. I've got two questions on that front. How many oysters do you have to produce to serve all those restaurants and your retail arm and your?
Yeah, more every year.
Said, you outgrew your production.
Yeah, right now we have about 20 million in the water, of which we'll harvest about 12 million this year.
12 million.
Yeah, so we sell to restaurants all over the country. We're starting to export to Asia a little bit and Colombia, surprisingly.
South America.
Yeah, we went on a mission with Governor McAuliffe down there. We got some accounts. And so trying to spread the word further out.
Yeah.
Trying to do our part to reverse the trade deficit, right?
Right. There you go.
We're patriots. But yeah, so there's, once again, the Chesapeake's the largest estuary in the country. It's so massive. It has plenty of room for expansion.
Yeah.
And this thing's it's one of the few foods that's good to grow, good to eat, and has just intangible benefits to the nth degree.
Well, 20 million, that's a lot of filters.
A lot of filters, yeah.
So it's helping the environment.
you think about 30 to 40 gallons per day,
mm-hmm.
each oyster. That's a lot of filtration.
That's crazy. You're helping the environment and the economy and filling our bellies with delicious food.
Yep.
It's like the triumvirate.
Yeah, there's no bad things about it.
Yeah. And as a successful businessman, I talk to a lot of folks who are just starting out or folks who want to start a business, and we're sitting in a place where I just finished a class about starting a business. What's a couple of pieces of advice that you would give to someone who wants to run a business? Like, what are something that you wish you knew when you started?
Yeah. Rules and regulations, taxes, things like that, which kind of could trip you up. There's no clear place to go to figure out all that you have to do. And opening up restaurants in different cities, we see it even more like, okay, well, this place I have to have 18 different licenses to operate. This one I have to have 4.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to figure that all out, but you have to take the time to do it correctly. Otherwise, you know, back taxes or penalties or fines, they'll just slow you down or you know, crush you. So
yeah,
just staying on top of what you need to do, keeping proper accounting from the get-go.
Huh.
You know, we operate so quickly. We're like, oh, I'll get to that later on, and I'll catch it up the right way. And you're operating so fast, you don't like spending time to do things correctly. Hmm.
So actually carving out the time to sit and from the ground up doing your
or
money
find
right.
Someone and you know, someone to help you out. You
sure.
Know, expert bookkeeper or something that can help you out.
That's what they taught us that in the course too.
Yeah.
They said take the time to do this.
Because when the bank comes looking for your information and it takes you like a while to produce it, they're going to have questions, right?
Uh-huh.
So you want to be able to turn around.
You don't
want
it to bite you in the ass later
when
you're trying to grow.
Exactly.
That's for sure. Do you have any spare time? Are there hobbies or things that you enjoy doing when you're not...
I keep thinking that I'll have spare time. Like if I just like work hard this week, then next week I can have spare time. I've got 3 kids. Beautiful wife, so we through this they get to eat at a lot of great restaurants, so we spend time that way. Hey, let's go out for a crab legs tonight or something.
Right.
But yeah, we try and get away. We have a place over in Chincoteague where we have the oyster farm. It's very desolate, very serene, so we like to go over there then drive over to the ocean.
It's so pretty there. I love it.
Yeah, we just don't have too much spare time, but I try to incorporate with family as much as I can.
Yeah, sure. Understandable. Are awards important and recognition? Like, because you guys have gotten quite a few.
Yeah, they were early on. For us, it was early on, it was just validation. And for Rappahannock winning at Squire's Best State Restaurant, that was really big because, one of the issues we have with at restaurants, everyone's like, oh, it's just an oyster bar. Well, it's a great oyster bar, but it's also got incredible talent and incredible food beyond that. And it took, some national writers to recognize it, whereas kind of local folks sometimes kind of miss the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, sometimes people
it's like objective eyes coming in.
If, national writers know Paul Kahn and the pedigree that he and Suzanne provide locally.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes maybe they don't,
mm-hmm.
but Dylan's is a chef. He's one of the best in the country.
Yes.
So that was a really good stamp of approval. But now for like the review in Charleston, I was more excited that it validated Kevin Kelly than validating us.
Yeah.
So now it's actually kind of cool to just see our people get that respect. So
oh, nice.
That's what's more important now.
Yeah. Again, like passing on the torch, like seeing, oh, wait, I'm creating jobs here. This is kind of cool. And seeing them succeed.
Right.
Because everybody rises when that happens.
Right.
The whole team.
Kevin's, he's paid his dues, but he's kind of shy and has always kind of operated under the radar. And when he worked for us in D.C., his dishes were just incredible. And then you notice, like, on Sundays, looking around, there's Jose Andres, there's Jeff Lubin, there's all these like the best chefs in town coming there to eat his specials. And you're like, but no one, the writers don't know about it. And mm-hmm. so putting him down with the same food in Charleston and having that blow minds down there. That's what's really cool to see.
Oh, so cool. So cool. Well, this has been amazing. I have enjoyed talking oysters with you so much.
Time's up already? Wow. I can talk about this stuff forever.
Well, not quite. I have a few speed round fun questions that I like to end with. Okay. What are there other things you'd like to discuss? Because I want to make sure, I always tell my guests if there's topics that they want to bring up, because this is your time on the mic.
I would just like to say, if anyone sees us, Ryan or myself, at one of the restaurants or at the oyster farm, don't hesitate to flag us down and ask us questions. If you're at a restaurant, talk to our shuckers. If you want to learn about anything they love when talking shop, just ask. Don't hesitate to ask any questions that you have.
Yeah.
Or email us, whatever. But it's one we of love the interaction.
One of those foods that could be intimidating, but it really shouldn't be.
It should be communal, and that's what we want to kind of reintroduce.
Yeah, it's a Virginia staple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you are from or grew up in this Commonwealth, you know it.
Yeah, exactly.
It shouldn't be so strange and weird.
Yeah. And if anyone ever looks down on you from up north and saying, hey, Blue Points are superior, now you know. You can turn back on and say, well, thank you. They are, because they were from Virginia.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, do you have a time machine? Were you there in the 1700s when there were still Blue Points?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Yeah.
So, don't hesitate to contact us or ask us for any questions.
Nice. Very nice. I will. I definitely will. All right. A couple of fun speed rounds. Let's see. I always start with this one because I love everybody's weird and varied responses. When you have a rough day and you come home, is there an embarrassing junk food that you run to kind of fill the hole or make your day better?
Breyer's ice cream. Cookies and cream. Gotta have it.
I've got vanilla in my fridge right now, or in my freezer right now. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
Doing my summer pound cake ice cream strawberries thing, or peaches.
Yeah, sometimes I'll put Sarah Lee's pound cake in the freezer.
Yes.
Because I love it frozen.
It's so good.
Slice it. Yeah, it tastes great.
All right, and I've loved this one lately, too. If you're on a road trip and your world travels and you stop into a convenience store with $5, what are you going to buy to keep you going down the road?
Fried chicken and a Mountain Dew.
Oh, there you go.
Maybe iced coffee, but fried chicken for sure, they have it.
Right,
and
right.
If they don't have it, I don't know, maybe some Funyuns or something. But
wow. Yeah. Oh, Funyuns. Yeah. Yes, that's a good one, too. Wait, and around here, they do have the fried chicken, right? Oh, my God. It's so good. Do you have a favorite food city that you might, if I gave you a ticket for free right now, that you'd take it and fly to just to eat?
I will tell you, D.C., I think, is unparalleled right now. The amount of talented chefs in the town, the different types of cuisines.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone used to plan their New York City trips and, where should they eat and stuff. I think D.C. now blows it out of the water.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's just everything. I was at Chico last week.
Oh, I don't know that place.
Scott Druneau. From The Source, and Danny Lee from Mandu. They opened up this fast casual Chinese Korean shop. Everything on there is fantastic.
I love Mandu. That's my favorite brunch up there.
Yeah, and those guys, there's awesome stuff. Tail Up Goat, just amazing restaurants all the time. Bad Saint,
over
and over again. It's just one up in each other. It's great.
Last time we were up there, we had Soju Bloody Marys at Mandu, and the day disappeared.
Yeah. It can
be very dangerous, those things.
That's a great town. And we're also enjoying when we go out to Los Angeles, because it's so far away, what they're doing out there.
Oh, yeah. I haven't made it out there yet. I need to. I'll come visit the new restaurant.
Yeah.
Do you have a name for it?
Rappahannock Oyster Bar.
That's
the name that
smart.
We really like the menu that we have. Obviously, it'll be changing depending on the local ingredients and stuff, but the lightness of it, that concept, we think that's the one that we want to put in every city.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's good, a good anchor.
Yeah, it's smaller size, 2,000 square feet, not a massive restaurant, just make it really fun.
Nice little old school raw bar, because mm-hmm. everybody can identify and yep. relate to that, and they love it.
And tell our story at each place.
Yeah, exactly. So cool. All right, and the last question, who in our region, which your region is a lot bigger than mine, but I do travel. I get in the car and on a plane. Who should I talk to next?
You know, funny enough, Christy Croxon, my wife, is an owner of James River Distillery.
Really?
And, yeah, she actually had the concept of Ostervit, which is agavit steeped in air oyster shells. Which
are you kidding?
Even Scandinavians are like, this is legitimately the best aquavit we've ever had. They do fantastic gins there also. But, you know, we always talk about supporting female artisans and stuff, and then it never really happens. But she's a prime example of someone that took a company and kind of pushed it really hard and
Whoa.
Introduced some cool things like that, the Ostervit that we do. That she does.
Boy, talk about the day disappearing. You have some agavit.
Yeah. Next time you're in Richmond, check out their distillery. They sell on site and stuff.
But I will. Where is awesome it located? Tour. That's a new one to me.
Yeah, it's right near Hardywood Brewery. It's near ABC headquarters.
Yeah.
Right behind the Diamond.
Yeah.
That's Scott's Edition area.
I grew up in Laurel Park, mm-hmm. and my first job out of school was in Scott's Edition.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, wait, that's a thing now?
That's a huge thing now.
They used to be nothing but industrial warehouses back in the 80s.
You got Peter Chang there. You got all the 18 breweries or so.
Crazy.
Cideries. She's there with James River Distillery. Reservoir is there, too, with the bourbon.
I went to an ice bar there one time. Is that bar. Is that still there?
I don't know.
It was weird. I was wondering if it would last. I was like, okay, this is new and weird, but I don't know. It seemed a little trendy.
There's a great little taco shop that took over this formerly adult bookstore.
Oh.
the whole place is just...
See, now I would have to riff on the name
then.
Remember
the Triangle Bookstore?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's now a taco shop.
Are you kidding?
Which has live music at times, and you know, Jason's band... Los Ramones.
Yes.
They played there before. Yeah,
nice.
It's cool. So the whole place is changing.
Okay, Richmond trip coming up. All right.
Oh, and go by Guar Bar. I've got a couple restaurants I'm affiliated with, but that one is awesome. It's just a cool place.
I love Guar Bar.
It's very cool.
I talked to Jason Tesoro and parked my car right next to it.
Nice.
And wished it was open.
Yeah, it's a fun place to go, and people, we always, when we have like out-of-towners, come in and we take them there. They have a great time.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Oh, nice. Well, this has been delightful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, can't wait to see you down at the farm and or one of the restaurants. Anytime.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the best time to come to the farm? Because I'd love to come and witness some of the things that you guys do there. Maybe not -2 January.
Yeah.
Like,
you don't
come I'm not going to do a Zersky's trip.
I think anytime from April through November is
okay.
a good time, because we still have our seed processing, and the seed to me is like the coolest thing, looking at baby oysters of different sizes. That's really cool. So basically anytime. The guys operate Monday through Friday. The restaurant's open 7 days a week through the winter too.
We're cool.
Only closed on Christmas and Thanksgiving Day, but we're soon gonna add Saturday processing, but right now anytime Monday through Friday. It's always a good time to come during the Urbana Oyster Festival. You get to
whole
side show, which is a lot of fun. Then come by their place afterwards.
That's gotten huge since I was a kid, because it used to be a little thing, and now it's a very big thing.
60 years in or so, And then for Richmond, too, we're doing, Fire, Flower, and Fork.
Remind me to talk to you about that when we're off mic.
And Susan was gracious enough to hook us up with a chef, Gabrielle Hamilton.
I know.
Farm,
Gabrielle.
So we're
I'm coming for
that.
You, honey. I want to talk to you.
She is awesome. So.
I'm going to be unabashed and unapologetic at how hard I pursue this talk. I'm just saying, I'm going to put it down and throw the gauntlet down right now.
Yeah.
Because she's kind of my hero.
Yeah. No, her and Dylan are going to be prepping Thursday night and serving on Friday. It's going to be awesome. So,
oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, my God. And tickets went on sale this morning.
Uh-oh. Better log in.
I'm going to log in the minute we turn. Let me go, guys, so I can go buy my tickets.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks, Travis. Appreciate it.
No worries.
Another good one, right? I should have mentioned at the top of the podcast, we recorded that at the Community Investment Collaborative, where I took a business course. And boy, did I learn a lot. It got me my mentor, Jay Lester. I have met so many other small businesses who have started out in a very similar way that Travis and Ryan started out, with just one grill, maybe one food truck, one dream, one idea, and they grew it into an empire. So I was very grateful to be able to sit and talk with Travis about his journey, because I'm hoping that a lot of other small businesses here in town end up being just as successful. Thank you so much for being my guest here today. Next up, it's Fire Flower Fork time. Hopefully I will have some audio of Gabrielle Hamilton's event at Miroir in Topping, Virginia on November 3rd. And I also plan on recording my Women in Food panel that I'll be moderating at Fireflower Fork on November 4th. There are so many tickets available for about 80 to 85 different food demonstrations, dinners, tastings, trips. I know one Fire Flower I went to, we toured the Sours spice plant, and that was incredible because I grew up in Richmond smelling the vanilla every week when I would drive past the plant on Broad Street. So check out Fire Flower Fork. I'll have the link in the show notes. Want to thank my sponsors, Teej.fm, and my sponsors over at patreon.com/audaciouspod, and Firefly and Cardinal Point for sponsoring today. And if you have a food event that you would like advertised for only $25, contact at audacious.co and we will get you set up. I'm also selling full sponsorships, so ask me for a press kit if you are so inclined. Send me your comments. Submit a review. What does Thanksgiving mean to you? How do you know it's Thanksgiving in your house? Record a voice memo and send it to me at contact@audacious.co. And until next time, I am Janae Libby of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. Shot out of a cannon today, feeling very grateful and full of gratitude. I am ferocious, very loquacious. And when it comes to learning about food and keeping those connections going, I'm audacious, and I hope you are too. Big love, big love.